All right, so Matt, I don't know if you know this, but I only know 25 letters of the alphabet.
What? But it, which one are you missing?
I don't know why.
It's good.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales. All right, everybody, here we are again. Matt, how you doing tonight, brother?
Man, I am doing pretty good.
Excellent. Excellent. So real quick, we'll say go check out the Podbelly Network at podbelly.com. You can find a list of shows that we're happy to be associated with, and you can find some tips and tricks on podcasting if you're thinking about starting a podcast. It'd be a good source of information for you. We also want to thank tonight's sponsor, Care Of, and we will talk more about them shortly coming up in the episode. While you're on the internet doing your thing, go over to patreon.com/graveyardtales and sign up to become a patron. We've got three different Patreon levels, 1, 5, and 10. And our $10 Patreon level just started getting a new drop of a brand new show that we're doing only for our $10 Patreon level. And if you've heard it, interested to know what you think. But if you're interested in checking out a show with me and Matt that has absolutely nothing to do with Graveyard Tales, then you should go sign up and become a $10 patron. You get some other bonuses too. You get a bonus episode a week, and you get the audio and video of that. Now, our $5 patrons, they get the bonus episode audio and video, and they get the ad-free audio as well as the $10 patrons. So there's a lot of choices and a lot of extra content over there. Matt and I are staying busy keeping up with the Patreon channels and stuff, but you should really check out the new show.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun. We're having fun with it. We've got some special guests lined up. And like Adam said, this is not Graveyard Tales light. This is a whole nother avenue. We think you guys enjoy it. It's not like anything we've done to date. So
right.
Check it out. We really think you guys are going to enjoy it.
All right, Matt. So that's all I've got for housekeeping. So why don't you tell us, what are we talking about tonight, brother?
So tonight, Adam and I looked into a haunted theater, which, you know, that's something we haven't done a whole lot of. Adam,
no, we haven't.
We've talked about a few. But, you know, we haven't really dug deep into a haunted theater. And
there's something special about haunted theaters. Like,
oh,
there's,
yeah,
there's a weird energy or something with theaters.
Hey, you know, it's odd. You know, I had my note. What's the deal with theaters? You know what? A hospital, a prison, you know, places like that. I totally get. But what is it about a theater that would hold enough energy to have a haunting?
You know what I think it is, to be honest with you? I think because I've known a lot of theater people growing up, and I see a lot of theater kids even now with the school that Michael goes to. I think theater kids are out there. They want to be seen. They all have a personality and a presence. You have to be in theater. You have to own the stage and be somebody on the stage. So I think that carries over into their spirit afterward.
Yeah.
And they still want to be on stage. They still want to be seen. They still want to be heard. And I think that has, in my opinion, that's what it has to do with these haunted theaters.
That is probably one of the best explanations of that I've heard.
Oh, well, good.
It makes perfect sense. So tonight, we're going to talk about the Twin City Opera House in McConnellsville, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, you talk about some ghost stories coming out of a place. Man, I was overwhelmed. I was like, holy cow.
Yeah.
I mean, just, it was just one after another after another. There is, though, something extremely unique about their ghost stories. Something that you don't see very often. And I'll get more into that when we start talking about the hauntings. But first, let's talk about the building itself. Let's talk about the history of it. It's pretty old. And so I think the age has got something to do with it as well.
Yep. And as we always say, go check our sources down on the bottom of the show notes. You can find where we found all this information and you can keep looking into it, because I guarantee you there's some history that I'm not going to cover and probably some details about the hauntings that Matt's not going to have time to cover as well. So go check our sources, bottom of the show notes, and it will give you an idea of the people that have been there and gone there and done the actual investigations that Matt and I were not able to do. And I'll try to blow through my history here pretty quick so we can get to the hauntings that Matt's got. But it sits at 15 West Main Street in McConnellsville, Ohio. And let's look at McConnellsville, Ohio, real quick. It's the county seat of Morgan County, Ohio, and it was established in 1819, and it was named after General Daniel Morgan, a decorated officer of the Revolutionary War. Now, on the east, it sits on the east bank of the Muskingum River. Now, McConnellsville was originally laid out in 1817, and it was named after Robert McConnell, a decorated general from the War of 1812, and he originally owned the land that the town was settled on. He purchased the land in 1817 for $1.75 per acre.
Wow.
Man, I wish acreage was still that price.
No kidding. I'd have a hell of a lot more land if it was.
I was going to say, I'd have that that cattle farm that I've been wanting for a long time. $1.75. Yep. I'll go get it out of my wallet right now and get me a cattle farm if it was only $1.75 an acre. Now, Morgan County, this county was carved from three other counties, and its location, like I said, was along the Muskingum River, and it made it very attractive to pioneers moving into the Northwest Territory following the Indian Wars in Ohio in 1795. There's an abundance of timber and furs, plus the rich river bottom land here, and it provided a wealth of opportunity for these new settlers. Now, once the lock and dam system was completed in 1841, the movement of goods and people on the river increased. So the Muskingum River lock and dam system are the oldest remaining hand-operated systems in America that are still in use.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty interesting. I didn't know there were any hand-operated lock and dams left.
Like, it's interesting, but I don't know that I would have known.
Yeah. If I hadn't.
I see now. I'm like, yeah, right.
Well, yeah. If I hadn't read it, I wouldn't have thought anything was still hand operated. I thought right. It would be mechanical.
Right.
But now the county's biggest attractions are the Big Bottom Memorial, which it's not really what you think. It's not what I thought. I thought the Big Bottom.
I know what you thought.
Yeah, buddy. It was the site of the Big Bottom Massacre in 1792. I was hoping it was something more fun than that.
Right. But that
Queen song, Fat Bottom Girls.
Or oh, yeah.
What is that band that was for the movie?
Spinal Tap?
Spinal Tap. That's it. I was about to say Scott was the dude from Spinal Tap when he was on our thing, but where he's like big bottom talk about mud flaps, my girl's got them.
Yeah, that, I love it. It
that's not what this Big Bottom Memorial is, which is a shame. And the Muskingum River locks and dams that I talked about, that's another one of the biggest attractions here. Now, the Opera House. When the Twin Cities Opera House and McConnellsville Town Hall were constructed, McConnellsville and surrounding towns were booming. Railroads and riverboats brought a lot of people, goods, and opportunities to the area. And McConnellsville, which, like I said, is the county seat, housed a number of businesses, but few relating to entertainment and leisure. So, you know, they were businesses, manufacturing, shipping, trade, stuff like that, but nothing for entertainment. Well, in 1889, the town council bought two lots in the burned district in the heart of McConnellsville. They called it that because there was a destructive fire that raged through the area in 1879. So, catchy name, the burned district.
Yeah, that's right.
And they bought these two lots for $4,000. Now, the plan was to build an official town hall and an opera house. Well, ground was broken on October 20th, 1889, with H.C. Lindsay, who was an architect from Zanesville, laying out the plans. Now, the plans, when they finished the building, was that it was going to be three stories tall and have a total cost of about $16,000. So, you know, that's a lot of money for the time. But retrospectively, there again, I'll take $16,000 back to this time and build an opera house and then make all my money back real quick if we could do that. But
that's what I would do if I had a time machine. I would go back and I would buy all this land super cheap.
Yep.
And then come back to now and I would own all this land.
Yep. Well, I've said that for a while. If time travel was a thing and I could work it out, I would go back to the early days of Texas and I would buy a huge swath of land in Texas. And then the stipulation would be that it would stay in the family until it got to, and I would calculate up how many greats I am down the line. And it could not be sold until the great, 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 whatever got it.
Until you had it.
And then I had it. And then I could sell part of it off and keep the rest of it for hunting and farming land. And I would be some rich Texas oil baron or something. Walking around with a big cigar, and
you'd be like John Dutton running around on Yellowstone.
You know,
I've got a helicopter.
Yeah.
Well, you got to keep an eye on this much land, so you need a helicopter.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I'd have horses, and you know, I'd still be doing this show, but it would be in a lot better studio than I'm in now. I would actually have a studio. Now, they were planning to have the theater on the first floor, the town government on the second floor, and have a ballroom on the third floor. So they had a big plan for this area. Well, the auditorium they had built featured a 3-degree downward slope for visibility and a dome for acoustics. So they were really thinking about this opera house. And outside, the building was topped with a tower that was 108 feet above the sidewalks. Now, they wanted a clock. They had planned on putting a clock in there, but the project ran over budget, so they abandoned the clock.
They just went down to the Five and Dime and just bought a clock and just hung it up there.
Some dude just hung his pocket watch off the edge of the tower. He's like, here, that's all we got the money for now. We spent too much on this dome of a opera house. Now, on May 28, 1892, the Twin City Opera House officially opened to the public. Now, they had the Arion Opera Company perform Gilbert and Sullivan's The Mikado for the grand opening show. So, a big show for the opening of the Twin City Opera House. Now, the cast, crew, and orchestra numbered nearly 100 people. All the 800 seats in the building were sold out. So they sold out 800 seats pretty quickly for the grand opening show. The trains also made extra trips to McConnellsville just to bring people to see the opera house. So you had the 800 people for the seats, plus they kept bringing other people that just wanted to see the new opera house. They didn't care about the show. You know, they just wanted to see it. It was an attraction within itself. But a lot of the patrons of the opera that actually bought seats were actually more interested in seeing the electric lighting that was installed, which newspaper called, quote, the light of the day, rather than seeing the show that was being put on. So they were, the opera house was the first building in the county to be lit by electric lighting. So that's why it was such a big deal and why so many people were coming to see it. It got a write up in the paper. So all these people were like, well, I don't care about the Mikado. I don't even know who Gilbert and Sullivan are, but I want to see these fancy electric lights. So they came, they bought tickets. They went in just to see it lit up with electric lights. So its grand opening was to be even more significant and spectacular than just having an opera house because of this lighting. Unfortunately, you know, there's always got to be an unfortunately. Unfortunately, the local generating plant failed. And so none of the lights at the theater worked. They burned out pretty quickly.
Oh, man, that stinks.
Yeah. So it had people running everywhere, all over, like heads with their chickens cut off, looking for oil lamps just to be able to run the show. And that took a good amount of time and effort.
I'm sure.
To get enough lights. Now, many of the people actually left when the lights went out, but the ones who stayed said the performance was actually amazing. So even in the oil lamps, when they couldn't run the new electric lighting, the Mikado went off without a hitch. It was great. People loved it. And the newspapers,
you got to think, I mean, that was pulling a lot of power. I mean, if you got a building this size and the lighting involved in this, it's not like you just put a few electric lights in your house.
Right.
It shut the grid down.
Yeah. And being the first one, they didn't know what to expect. They didn't know what it would draw, you know, the power that it would draw. So it wasn't up to snuff for that. And they shut it down.
Did they not have a dress rehearsal?
I guess not.
Hey, the lights went out. I'm glad this didn't happen on opening night.
Right. Well, they probably turned it on for a couple minutes, went, yeah, that works. Turn it off. Don't burn out the lights. And then after leaving it on for a while on opening day, it shut down. Well, the newspapers reported that although the crowd was small, they were treated to a spectacular performance. Well, since the electricity at the time was deemed unreliable, it was decided to go back and complete the installation of the gas and oil fixtures, which had been called for in the original plans, but they left out. So gas footlights were installed on the stage. A gas chandelier was hung in the dome, which it could be lit through small ports on that were cut into the dome's perimeter. So they went and retrofitted everything for gas and oil after some people go, this electricity thing, it's not reliable. So,
well,
you know,
and nowadays having something like that would be really cool.
Yeah.
You know, you imagine 2024, you're taking a tour of this place and they're going, that's a gas chandelier up there. And then to be able to tell this story about the electricity going out, I mean, that's a great feature. You know, I mean, you just don't see big glass chandeliers in places like that now, but to have one would be really cool. And look, honestly, I got no idea if it's still there. You know, I would assume they would have preserved something like that. But I mean, I think that kind of stuff is crazy cool.
Well, and nowadays where a lot of cities' power grids are having brownouts and stuff like that, it wouldn't be a bad thing to retrofit your house with gas lamps and stuff in case. Now, the Twin City Opera House installed a permanent projection booth for movies in 1913, and the best seats to a movie could cost as much as 20 cents, Matt, while most others were only a nickel. And I can remember my great-grandparents telling me that they would go see a movie when they were dating, and it would cost them a nickel a piece to see a movie. And even when I was a kid, you know, movie tickets weren't that cheap. They're ridiculous now, but even when I was a kid, I thought a nickel a ticket was amazing.
So it's funny that you bring that up, because it makes me think when I was in, I'm going to say middle school, junior high school, seventh, eighth grade, not old enough to drive. One of our regular Friday, you know, Saturday night things was, you know, we met at the mall. And you get dropped off at one end of the mall, okay, and you had a $20 bill,
mm-hmm.
okay, that was it. That was your money. It was usually, in my case, it was my allowance for the week for doing, you know, the chores that I had. And that $20, okay, it would get you, it would buy you supper. Mm-hmm. You could go to Taco Bell, and back then you could get like tacos for, you know, 65 cents or something. They were cheap.
Yeah.
You know, so you got two or three tacos, and a drink, and you've spent less than $5.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could tool around the mall. We would hit the arcade. So you spent $5 or $6 in the arcade. And as long as you had like $7, $6.50 at the end of the night, you could buy your movie ticket. So that was everybody's goal, is make sure you've got $6 or whatever to get in the movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, it kind of stayed like that for a while. But, man, if I took everybody to go see the whatever the last Avengers movie was a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So all of it, me, Amanda, and all five kids.
Probably $200.
It's close. Tickets. You know, yeah. it was $150. Yep. You know, by the time everybody got, you know, a soda and, you know, a couple of big buckets of popcorn to share.
And that was a few years ago.
Yeah, that was a few years ago.
It'd be even more now. It probably would be $200 now.
So needless to say, Matt doesn't go to the movies that often.
Right, right. But if we could get them back to 20 cents for a good seat, I would be going to the movies more. So the theater began using Vitaphone technology in 1930 to show, quote, talking pictures. Now, in 1936, it closed for the only time in its history to install a more updated form of sound technology. And the old projection booth was removed and replaced, and the auditorium itself was renovated. Now, movies remained the king of entertainment at the Opera House throughout the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and the stage began to crumble because of its age, lack of use, and the effects from the 1909 fire that was there. So that 1909 fire is probably going to come up again in Matt's ghost stories here soon. Because you got to think, if there was a big fire there, there's some fear and stuff like that. So it may play into it a little bit. But remember, it's 1909. Now, Galen Finley, who took over the Opera House in 1962 after working there for years, made the stage usable again. And in the 1970s, a long list of fire code violations nearly shut down the theater. Well, thousands of dollars were put into new wiring, curtains, and fire extinguishers to keep the place up and running. And Finley sold the theater in the early 1990s to its current owner, the nonprofit Opera House Incorporated. Well, over the years, the Opera House has accommodated a bunch of performers and celebrities. The fire and brimstone evangelist Reverend Billy Sunday, William Jennings Bryan, and Senator Albert Beveridge spoke there. And high school commencements and local minstrel shows were staged here as well. Traveling shows that came by train would often bring these lavish productions to town. And specially constructed doors at the rear of the stage. So there's these special doors that they made. They allowed the loading and rigging of some enormous backdrops that they had. That set pieces over 20 foot tall could be slid through the narrow doors. So I think that's pretty cool that they got their own doors, specialty doors that they built in there that you could slide these 20 foot tall things through, but they were probably more narrow than normal doors. So now there was a trap door that was cut into the stage floor. Well, a couple trap doors that were in the stage floor. And this was so that as soon as the curtains closed, The doors opened and the actors dropped down a wooden slide to the dressing rooms below, which made the quick costume changes possible. So think about that, Matt. That to me is wild. And I know is not the only place that does stuff like that, but just the thought of this is wild. You're on stage doing a show, the curtain's closed, you've got to go do a quick costume change for your next thing. Well, instead of just running off the side into the dressing room, you hop on this slide that takes you woo down below the stage to the dressing room.
Yeah.
Now, my thought is, okay, that's quick. It's fun. It's cool to say that you've got that. I slid down the trap door. Yay. But then what do you got to do to get, you got to climb the stairs to get back to the stage after the change. There's no like spring loaded thing that shoots you back on stage.
Yeah.
So I don't see that it fixed the problem that much, to be honest with you.
Yeah. I don't know. That is kind of neat though. If the whole purpose was we got to get you into the dressing room quickly, you know, we're worried about getting you back out on stage, but the main thing is getting you out of that costume and into your next one. And, you know, that's a good idea, you know, having like a little quick elevator that would have shot you right back up would have made it even better. But still, a neat solution for a problem.
Yeah, and I think it could be cool for performances too. If you have to have an actor disappear or something, and just have them stand on that trap door, and then it opens, and they go whoop, and they're gone.
Yeah. I remember reading something years ago, and I think it was Faust was the. Was the play or whatever it is, where I think there's a scene where like the devil pops up because you know that I think that's what it's all about is the guy makes a deal, sells his soul, and you know the actor would be launched up onto the stage, you know, and reappear, you know, in some smoke or whatever. And I always thought that was incredibly cool to be able to do something like that.
There's still live shows that do that now. I've seen like vocalists do that. And my fear is always, what if you hit your head on the side of that thing as you're being shot up?
Yeah.
Because some of them don't just lift you like an elevator. Some go, wah! And like you catch air.
Yeah, so that's the thing. What if this launches me into the front row?
Yeah, and you went a little sideways, and you went, oh, crap, and you go flying off the stage or something.
How was Peter Pan last night? Oh, it was great. We caught him in the third row.
Yeah, he only broke one leg. So, I mean, I think that's what they tell him to do anyway. So
I didn't anticipate crowd surfing it.
See, that's I never became a thespian because I don't have the guts to do it if there's going to be a lot of launching like that. I just can't do it.
Yeah. I was always an extra.
Yeah.
You know, I never really was into it. I was too busy, you know, playing sports and stuff, but
you are a little extra, Matt.
I am totally extra. But, I always thought it would be really cool to be in one of those plays. I just didn't have the opportunity. So I would try to be around it, and I would always jump in and be an extra. You know, I was some guy in a crowd, you know, some guys, you know, giving a speech, you know, like a campaign speech. And I'm one of the guys going, yeah, you know, that was my extent.
You were man number three.
Yeah. Didn't even get that much credit. You know, crowd member.
Yeah. Right. Lumped into a group. Now, the frameworks for these trapdoors, they're actually still visible under the stage. And also under the stage is what they call dramatic evidence of a potentially disastrous fire that occurred there in the early 1900s. The ash pit for the coal furnace sat directly beneath the stage. The furnace had been cleaned and restocked for a play, so the pit was filled with still hot ash as the performance began. Now, while the play was in progress, the heat of the ash ignited the joists supporting the stage. The curtain was dropped and the orchestra in the pit began to play. So the fire brigade coming in through the stage door extinguished the blaze, but not before a large hole was burned through the stage floor. So the local stories are that the performance actually continued on half of the stage and the opera house narrowly avoided a tragedy.
The show must go on.
Exactly. Hole or not, just don't fall into that hole. That's not a trap door to the dressing room. That is a trap door to Hades.
Yeah, that is a real fire over there.
Yep. Yep. Just ignore that.
Pay no attention. You know, show's happening here.
Yep, exactly. Now, they say perhaps nothing in the theater is more interesting or mysterious than its tunnels. So for generations, the story has been told that the tunnels were once used to conceal the movements of escaped slaves who were fleeing the South. They were said to have linked the building that once stood on the Opera House foundation to other locations in the village and ultimately to the banks of the Muskingum River. Now, after the theater was constructed, the tunnel leading across Main Street, then Center Street, to the Kennebec Hotel was used by performers for traveling to and from their rooms. Now, only the entrance is visible. The tunnel was filled in during the 1930s out of a concern that the increasingly heavy traffic would cause a collapse. So before, when they built the tunnel, they had horse and buggy, stuff like that. But because traffic was getting heavier and you were getting heavier cars, they were afraid this tunnel would make the road collapse. So they filled it in and you don't have this tunnel anymore. But any evidence that the site was a station on the Underground Railroad, they say, is inconclusive. They say, strangely, very little information exists about this prominent spot on the village square during the Civil War. To me, this is me interjecting here, that's not surprising to me.
Oh, because yeah.
If you are a stop on the Underground Railroad and you're trying to help escape slaves, you don't want it written down. You don't right. want somebody going, taking notes. Yesterday, we helped out 60 slaves, and their names were, they came from this, and we sent them here. You don't want that information out. You know, you just want to do your good deed, get them off, and then not say anything about it. Because during those times, if you help them out, you were just as liable as they were.
Exactly. You were viewed as a criminal.
Right. So it's not surprising to me that there's not a plethora of information about it being a stop on the Underground Railroad. It makes sense.
Yeah. And you think that out of all the places we've talked about over the years, we've only had one or two that were known to be locations or locations of the Underground Railroad. Essentially, they were access points.
Yeah.
They were places where you could, if you can get here, you know, then this is where you're going to pick up and get direction on where to go next and get you to safety.
And that's basically what they're saying this opera house was.
And where it's located in Ohio, I would not doubt it.
Yep, exactly. Because if they could get there, they could get them down to the tunnels that went out to the Muskingum River, and then they could hop a boat and go north away from the Confederacy.
Yep.
So it makes sense, and makes sense that it's not a definitive thing.
Right. Yeah. They didn't have signs out, you know, Underground Railroad and a little arrow pointing down.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So I don't know why they said it's surprising. It's not surprising to me.
Yeah.
It's surprising to me that we know of so many stops on the Underground Railroad.
That's true. I'm with you there.
Now, this says that the Opera House has many secrets and it is reluctant to give them up. In the late 1980s, while doing electrical renovations, workers discovered a hidden stairway leading from the second floor mezzanine to the village offices on the first floor below. How long that stairway had been hidden is uncertain, and there's no indication that it existed before the 1980s discovery, and no one in the village could recall any mention of it. So there again, that may have something to do with the Underground Railroad, but it also could have something to do with bootlegging, any number of illegal activities, illegal prostitution, perhaps, since it went down to the offices and the town hall offices and stuff. It could be a way, hey, sneak up here to my office, and use my secret stairway.
Yep. And, you know, we've talked about a lot of places that had tunnels underneath, and, you know, the tunnel would give you access to somewhere else in town or the buildings next door. And bootlegging was absolutely the reason. So it wouldn't surprise me if there was, you know, it's an opera house, it's theater people, you know, and, you know, in the early 1900s during Prohibition, you know, these were the people that were probably more likely to imbibe, you know, get together after a show and have a drink. And they couldn't just walk across the street to a bar because it was illegal.
Right. Well, think about the Shanghai tunnels.
Yeah.
That we covered. The Shanghai tunnels, not only for Shanghaiing, but they were used for illegal rum running and stuff as well. So I love these hidden tunnels and secret tunnels and stuff, but I'm not surprised by them.
Right.
I think there's probably more that we don't know about that have just been covered up and never spoken of.
Yeah.
So,
man, I want a secret tunnel so bad.
You and me both.
I wish I had a secret tunnel connecting this building to my house and I could go under. That would be, and then in the house, it would be a bookcase and you pull a book and it opens, you know, I've said this before. That would be incredible to me, is to be able to go, oh, you like my Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, and then all of a sudden the bookcase opens up and,
I've said before, I want a panic room, you know, under the stairs that looks like a bookcase, but I also would like a tunnel that goes from the panic room out to some like bunker or something in the backyard that's underneath the backyard that you don't know is there. And that way a family that I don't want to see comes over, I can sneak into my panic room and then down through that tunnel and they'd go, oh, he's just in the panic room and go in there. Well, I'm not. I have disappeared entirely.
Yeah. Yeah.
But knowing me, Ashley would make me put the recording studio out there and then she could have this room back and not have to have a studio in this room.
Right.
So it wouldn't be a secret bunker. It would be my recording bunker.
Yeah. So you can tell by a lot of the cool aspects of this theater that, you know, there was some activity there that's not documented, you know, that still has a lot of mystery behind it. And it always seems that those kind of facts tend to go right along with the ghost stories that are told about a specific location.
Yep.
And the Twin Cities Opera House is no exception. You know, the theater has reportedly been haunted since the 1960s. And that was when a janitor ran out of the building and never came back. He's like, I'm out.
Yeah, I'm done with this.
There's something in there helping me mop and I'm gone.
All right, Matt, so let's take a second and talk about one of our longtime sponsors of Graveyard Tales, and that's Care Of. Now, what is Care Of? Well, Care Of is a health and wellness company that ships high-quality, personalized vitamins, supplements, and powders conveniently to your door every month. Care Of offers a curated set of products that are designed to work with research-backed ingredients and optimal doses. And Care Of makes taking your vitamins on the go so convenient. With individual daily packs that are perfect for a busy routine, you can just throw a few in your bag or your purse or whatever, take them with you. And they're made with a plant-based compostable film to help limit the impact on the environment without compromising on the quality and safety of their products. And another cool thing that they've just started doing, Matt, is they're selling some of their best-selling vitamins in bottles now. So if you don't want to get the individual packs and you say, I just want this one vitamin, I don't want to do the whole routine, you can do that and buy the bottle from them. But those daily packs are amazing.
Yeah, it makes it so simple if you take multiple supplements to make sure you don't forget one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've got to travel, maybe you leave town pretty frequently. All you got to do is just grab the number that you need, pitch them in your bag, and yep, you're ready to roll. And the cool thing about Care Of is when you take the online quiz, it really helps you get the right supplements to meet your health goals.
Right.
You know, you want to do this, Care Of's going to recommend, supplements that would help you achieve that goal. And it doesn't take any time to take, and it asks you very specific questions on what you want to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so then you don't have to stand there in the vitamin aisle and wonder, well, should I, what about this one? Well, I really want to do this. Maybe these three will be what I need. You can take all that out of the equation. Take the Care Of quiz and get set up with a supplement regimen that's going to be right for you.
Yep. I know it's been great for you and me and Ashley, because it is, like you said, it's quick and you get specific supplements for your specific needs. And then if you go on vacation, you got them all there and you're not carrying 50 million bottles with you like I used to do.
Exactly. So if you guys think Care Of may be right for you, just go to takecareof.com, enter our promo code GRAVE50, that's GRAVE50, for 50% off your first Care Of subscription order.
That's right. For 50% off your first Care Of subscription order, go to takecareof.com and enter our code GRAVE50, GRAVE50.
But it was a paranormal investigator who convinced the executive director of the Opera House, Adam Shriver, to turn the abundance of paranormal activity in the theater into a business.
Now,
it's been said that every part of the historic building has paranormal activity, and it's widely recognized as one of the most haunted buildings in Ohio. Now, the investigator I'm referring to, Eric Glosser, was a team member of the United Paranormal Project. And this was a group that he founded, and the Twin Cities Opera House was kind of their home base.
Hmm.
So, you know, we'll talk about this more. I think Adam's got some things to share with this. But we don't see a lot of haunted places that have their own dedicated paranormal investigator team.
Right. Right. And I think it's a good idea. And the reason being, and this is not just my idea, I've heard other people say it and I've adapted it from there, but I think a lot of paranormal activity, think about a haunted place, Matt, mm-hmm. and you've got, if they are the spirits of people who have passed on, you've got, say, me and you going in there, two random dumbasses that come in here and start asking questions, poking around, got a bunch of lighty equipment and stuff. If they are the spirits of people left here on Earth, they don't know who we are. They don't trust us. They don't anything. But if you have a dedicated group that comes in every week mm-hmm. or a couple times a week, they get to know these people.
Yeah.
They get to understand these people. And it seems like from everything I've seen and everybody I've heard talk about it, the more you go to a place, the more activity you will get because the spirits get used to you. And they maybe not put on a show. That's kind of the wrong term, but maybe it works for the opera house. But they interact with you more. They are willing to show you more and do more for you. So we don't hear about it much, but I honestly think we should hear about it more.
Yeah.
Because
that's,
I think,
you know what? That's not an angle I've really considered. I do think the familiarity plays into it considerably. My thought was always, look, if you take a trip and you're like, hey, we're going to stay at this haunted hotel. Hey, we're going to go take the tour of this haunted museum mm-hmm. or bed and breakfast or whatever. You're there for a few hours.
Yep.
You stay overnight. If you have any kind of experience, you're lucky.
Yep.
I mean, you're really taking such a small window of time and keeping your fingers crossed that you're going to experience something that's paranormal.
Expecting something paranormal to happen in your short window.
Right. And most likely it's not going to happen.
Right.
You know, but you'll get to hear all the stories and, you know, talk to the staff and hear their experiences. The reason the staff have the best stories is because they're there.
Yep.
They're there, you know, every day or they're there for, you know, multiple hours. The likelihood that they're going to experience something is much higher. So if you're a paranormal investigator, wouldn't you want to have that kind of access to a place?
I would.
You know, yeah. to really dig down, to really spend some time and get a feel for the place and what's going on. I think that would be an investigator's dream.
Yep.
Is, I honestly is to have think that kind need, of access.
Yeah, we need to have more places that have dedicated ghost hunters that come in every other night, every night, a few times a week, something. Rather than having paranormal groups that travel all over the world. Now, yeah. You could still travel to other places, but I think all paranormal hotspots should have a dedicated group that get to spend a lot of time there. They yeah. close down, you know, paranormal group comes in mm-hmm. and they spend the night there.
Yeah.
And they just see and document and all this. And the spirits would then get used to, oh, well, Matt and Adam are coming in at 8 o'clock. You know, they're going to ask me some questions. I think tonight I might give them some answers.
Or, yeah, there you go.
You know, knock in response to something. And I think there's a lot of familiarity that comes into play when you get dedicated groups like the Twin Cities Opera House has.
Yeah.
That they will be able to get more than if you and I walk in for one night or two consecutive nights. They're going to get more just out of familiarity.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Eric Glosser, you know, who founded this United Paranormal Project, or the UPP as they shorten it. He managed the business aspect of this for the Opera House, you know, which involved, you know, plenty of time for his team to investigate, but to also help other investigators that were coming in, you know, give them some tips, places to go, things to try, because maybe it had helped them gather some evidence. So yeah. Again, it's not just because you're going to take it and be like, this is our place. These are our ghosts. But if you know it well, an outside investigation team coming in there, I mean, you would be a wealth of information for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. I'm with you, Adam. I think if we're going to get definitive evidence of this kind of stuff, the stuff that just tells the world, look, you know, this is what's happening and there's no other explanation for it other than, you know, something from the spirit realm making this happen. That's how it's going to occur. It's yep. not going to occur from somebody going and spending the night or 5 or 6 hours in a place and setting up a dozen cameras and just hoping and praying that they get something. It's going to be yep. from a group that is consistently in the same location with that much activity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Eric Glosser was a retired police officer who said he saw plenty of paranormal activity while he was on the force, but he was quick to say that you just don't go back to the station and tell everybody what you saw.
Yeah.
And again, this goes back to, you know, something that, I say often. It's people that have something at stake should be taken seriously when they decide to speak out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a police officer, you know, absolutely, you know, police officers, military personnel, you know, elected officials, anything like that. If they're willing to say, this is what happened to me, you can believe it or not, but I know what I saw or I know what I experienced, you know, take them seriously because they're really putting their reputation on the line. Mm-hmm. You know, if I tell somebody about, you know, the house that I grew up in and all the stuff that we have, they think, oh, it's cool. Or, you know, Matt's a nut job. I don't care. You know, it's like, you think whatever. I'll tell you the story if you want to hear it. But if I was in a position to where everybody thinking that, you know, I was off my rocker or I was just pulling your chain, and it could cost me my job or my credibility, I probably would think twice. You know, so, you know, with those folks, I think you ought to listen.
I agree. Yep.
Now, inside the halls of the Twin City Opera House, there are multiple spirits. But Glosser said most of them are friendly. Visitors to the Opera House usually experience any number of interactions, like hearing noises, being touched, disembodied voices, sounds of singing.
Hmm.
They hear footsteps. They even see shadow people. Now, other things will become apparent when you listen to your recorders or watch videos. And a lot of video evidence after the fact, tons of EVPs have come out of the Opera House. And look, I'm going to talk a little bit more about them, but man, the Twin City Opera House website has, you know, some of these EVPs posted where you can listen to them yourself. And you know how Adam and I always talk about, you know, listen, it says I'm going to kill your dog. And then you hear, see, I'm going to kill your dog. That's not what these are. I mean, these are, you can hear clearly, you know, what's being said. Cool. I mean, almost to the point that you go, that cannot be real. I've never heard one this clear. So they're pretty good. So, you know, if that's something you enjoy, go to the Twin Cities Opera House website and check out those. And we're going to get into more of it in just a minute. Now one of the spirits that, that Glosser said he actually befriended was a man named Robert Lowry. And Robert's spirit reportedly lives in the catwalk. Now, the story is that he was a stagehand during the 20th century. Glosser said that after about a year of working at the Opera House, he finally met Robert. He asked the spirit if he could drop the temperature in the room, and it did, from 80 to 65 degrees.
Wow.
Now
that's a big drop.
That is a huge drop. But, you know, when people talk about, you know, it's dropped 3 to 4 degrees, you know, a lot of people can say, oh, that's a draft. There's a cool breeze. Mm-hmm. There's a window open. 15 degrees is not a cool breeze. Okay.
No.
That is a significant change.
That's massive. Yeah.
And Eric said at first he didn't know if he had actually captured a ghost. But when he started listening to his audio back, he found a voice that sounded like a man who was about half drunk, and it said, I've got red wine.
Hmm.
So Glosser nicknamed him Red Wine Robert. Now, Eric claimed that he had over 5,000 EVPs and more than 300 of them were taken from inside the theater. 300 EVPs from one location. That's incredible.
Jeez.
Now, he went on and explained in an interview that his thought, there were two types of EVPs. There were residual and intelligent. Now, residual EVPs, as Glosser explained, that are like frozen sections of time on repeat. You know, like it's just on a loop. You know, the audio version of that stone tape theory.
Right.
He said, you know, the spirit is unaware that humans are there. But intelligent spirits are able to respond to humans and answer questions. And he said, most of the EVPs collected from the Twin City Opera House are intelligent. You know, they are providing responses. Now, Robert's ghost once told Glosser that there are 14 spirits living in the opera house. Glosser claimed that he knew of 10 for sure, but never learned all of their names. Okay?
Hmm.
So let's take a look at old Red Wine Robert's cohorts. All right? The first one is a man named Everett Miller, and this is where you're going to see the uniqueness of these stories. And what's so unique about them is the UPP would research when they would begin to interact with one of these spirits, and they have actually connected the spirit activity with a living person, with an actual person, not a living person, but a person who lived and had a connection to the opera house.
That's cool.
And I mean, even to the point of having photographs of these individuals. So the first one is Everett Miller. Now, investigators may potentially encounter the spirit of Everett Miller, who was the usher at the Opera House for 30 years. And they say that he still watches over the Opera House and has been contacted and seen numerous times during investigations. He is his ghost is easily recognized by the white suit that he wears. And many employees and visitors have reportedly seen this ghostly white figure of a man wearing a white suit in the theater. Hmm. And it's also been documented that a former manager of the Opera House always wore a white suit.
That's a cool tie-in to history. I like
it. Yeah, absolutely. But there is an EVP recorded in the basement that contains a ghostly voice responding with Everett when they asked the spirit if it would share its name. Okay. So, I mean, there it is, a direct connection to someone that was involved in the theater for 30 years.
Yeah.
Now these next three, this is a pretty interesting story. So Victoria was a stage performer from West Virginia who frequently performed at the Opera House. From her first visit to the Opera House in 1892, She took a fancy to a stagehand who worked there by the name of Robert Lowry.
Hmm.
Over a short period of time, Victoria and Robert grew closer and closer and eventually had an affair, which, of course, in the late 1800s was not acceptable, especially since Robert was already married.
Yeah.
Victoria became pregnant as a result of this affair and stopped performing at the Opera House. So the affair, having a child out of wedlock, I mean, this was a secret that Victoria had to keep out of fear of being shunned by the community. It's just the way it was then.
Yeah.
The consequence of their love was a baby girl, which Victoria named Elizabeth. Now, Victoria didn't return to the Opera House for a few years, but eventually came back to perform and told Robert that he was Elizabeth's father. And in 1903, Victoria made the trip from West Virginia again to perform at the Opera House. She brought then 10-year-old Elizabeth on this trip so that she could visit her father, Robert. Now, Victoria and Elizabeth were staying at the Kennebec Hotel. Remember, Adam mentioned that earlier. A lot of the performers would stay in that hotel across the street, and they had access through the tunnel that went under the street.
Mm-hmm.
But that night, Victoria had to leave her daughter at the hotel to perform at the Opera House because at the time, Elizabeth was suffering from a heavy fever. And instead of accompanying her mother, she stayed to rest in the hotel. But tragically, after the performance, Victoria returned to the hotel and found that Elizabeth had died from her illness.
Mm.
So naturally, Victoria was devastated, and she never returned to McConnellsville. It's not certain how long Victoria actually lived or when she died, but it is speculated that when she did die, her spirit returned to the Opera House in search of Elizabeth and Robert. Now, the United Paranormal Project captured an exceptionally clear EVP of a female voice in apparent distress saying, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I swear I'm sorry, I didn't mean to." And you can hear this one on their website. So it is believed that this EVP was Victoria trying to send a message to Elizabeth. Now, Elizabeth's ghost can also be seen in the theater, and her spirit is typically seen looking down on the seats from the catwalk. So you're down in the theater, you look up, and it looks like there's a spirit that's peering over the edge of the catwalk looking down at
you. Oh, yeah.
Now, sometimes she's not alone, and she is seen with another young girl named Sarah. And Elizabeth and Sarah have been known to play with their toys in the catwalk. They throw pebbles in the sub-basement. I mean, the girls are just always around. And if you listen closely, you may even hear their giggles or see them looking around corners at you. And Adam's already shaking his head. He's like, no.
No.
No, double kid ghosts.
No. Got to hear both of them giggling and running. No, thank you.
Now, they say that these two can be pretty shy, but once they warm up, you will become aware of their presence.
They can stay shy.
Yeah. It says, there have been multiple teams that have physically seen the two of them, one brunette and one blonde. That's pretty cool. Okay.
It's cool, but it's also really creepy.
Yeah.
Like,
but
I would be creeped the hell out if that were the case.
Here's where the story really gets interesting. Sarah was Elizabeth's friend in life as well.
Mm.
And they played together when their parents were busy. Sarah was reportedly, extremely distraught after Elizabeth's death. Can you imagine being 10 and losing one of your best friends?
No.
That's horrible. But oddly enough, Sarah lived to be 92.
Hmm.
So could her spirit have returned to the Opera House in the form of her 10-year-old self to play with her long-lost friend?
I think it's possible. I recently heard a story about a lady who lived in this house somewhere for many years. She was 80 or something when she died, but they apparently have her ghost as a child back there. And through communications or whatever, they've determined that that was the age she felt the safest. And so that's the age that she reverted to in her spirit form.
Yeah.
Obviously none of us know if that's possible or not, but I think it might be.
Yeah.
If you're free from the bonds of mortality and physics and stuff when you die, then possibly you could take a different form.
It makes me wonder, because this is something that I don't think you and I have really ever talked about, at least not in depth. The idea of what form your spirit would take, because
yeah,
I mean, we hear so much about, you know, the people that, that died tragically, you know, in, middle aged, or even, you know, younger. And that's the image that you see. But for someone that just died of natural causes, lived a full long life, and for whatever reason, their spirit decides to hang around, why would they be in their much older form? If you think, well, you know, your body is just a shell, and your spirit, your soul, your consciousness, however you want to approach it, it doesn't really take on any of those features, you know, those physical aspects. Why couldn't you be whatever you wanted?
Right.
I mean, if that was a wonderful time in Sarah's life, and her spirit, for whatever reason, decided that it was going to stick around, then absolutely. Now, and I've got to think, you know, if Sarah lived to be 92, there is a really good chance that she was aware of Elizabeth's spirit being seen in the theater.
Yep, you would think.
Yeah. I mean, somebody would have, this story would have gotten to her somehow. I just can't imagine that it didn't. And so if consciously in life she thought, you know, that was a wonderful time, you know, she was such a good friend, and I didn't get to spend enough time with her before she was gone. You know, if her spirit was stuck here, why not?
Yeah.
I'll tell you this. I would love to go back and be a kid. If that was the option, yeah. You know, if you could say, hey, your spirit's hanging around. If you want to be in the form of a child, you know, go have at it.
And then you can freak out people like me the rest of eternity.
Yeah. But, you know, the cool.
But it also would go to if you and your wife lived to y'all were in your 90s and you passed away and y'all both stayed here.
Yeah.
Couldn't you then revert to the form that y'all were both happiest
in? Yeah, why not?
Like, go back to your 20s, and y'all are hanging out in your 20s together again for the rest of eternity.
Oh, yeah.
In this place. I don't know. I mean, I think if that's possible, if you can do that, I don't know why more don't choose that. But maybe it's not a choice you get all the time.
That's the thing.
Maybe it's just subconsciously, you know, the universe, God, whatever, knows that this is what you're most happy as. And send. I don't know. It boggles my mind trying to think of it.
I know. But, and it brings up a whole other topic of talking about, you know, residual hauntings and intelligent hauntings. And, you know, I mean, the spirits of these two girls seem to be well aware of a human presence in the theater and interact.
Right.
But how many hauntings have we heard where it's like, all you see is this spirit goes from point A to point B, and it happens fairly frequently. And, you know, you begin to think, okay, whatever's going on right here, that has no connection to the living at all. You know, they don't interact. They don't recognize that there's anybody there. You know, that we've talked about where spirits will pass through walls because in their realm, everything is exactly the same. If they're even conscious or thinking about that. You know, if you're not just watching the replay from the energy of an event, you know, going over and over, it you might as well be watching on TV. I mean, you wouldn't try to talk to something you're watching on a videotape. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're just seeing it over and over and over. I mean,
I don't know. I've had friends try to talk it.
Yeah. But the thing about at least these three spirits that I think is so amazing is that they have evidence of all four of these individuals being around the theater, photographs of these individuals. I mean, Victoria's performances, and they were documented in the history of the theater. You know, Robert Lowry being an employee there. You know, they have evidence that, yes, indeed, he was there. They have pictures of Sarah and Elizabeth. Okay, so they know that these people existed. These are not names they have tagged these spirits with just as nicknames. You know, they were real people. And their spirits continue.
So much cooler when you can tie historical people like that definitively to something. You see a picture, and then you see a spirit that looks just like this picture.
Yeah.
You're not getting a blob and then making up this could have been a jilted lover that took their life here and they stayed here. And then that story gets passed on for generations. This, you know, you see a picture of Sarah and you go, oh, well, that looks just like the ghost I saw last night. And then you go look up the history and, yep, sure enough, died when she was whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I don't have words for it because it's so cool.
I know, it blows your mind a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, in the sub-basement, which there's quite a bit of activity down there, visitors will see a white rocking chair. Now, the chair mysteriously appeared in 2020 while the theater was undergoing renovations.
Well, that's weird.
Now, I mean, I think that, you know, when they say it didn't just like materialize, it showed up. It was moved. Somebody found it, whatever. And it was put down there as they're doing these renovations. And none of the staff took responsibility for placing the chair. So nobody knew who did it. But it caused a stir among the investigators who were immediately drawn to it. Now, during an impromptu seance in the basement in July of 2020, it was learned that the chair belonged to a woman named Gloria. The investigators claim that they learned that Gloria had been a resident of McConnellsville and at one time had worked at the courthouse. The white rocker belonged to her. Investigators also report that Gloria was Sarah's mother and that her spirit stayed in the opera house to watch over the two girls. Now, Gloria had become very agitated with all the construction garbage and debris left behind at the end of the workers' day. So when visiting the basement of the opera house, you know, it said, you have to respect Gloria. And you need to ask permission before you sit in the white rocking chair. If Gloria doesn't want you there, you'll know it. You'll feel it.
Oh, really?
Like, I want to sit in that rocking chair. I want to know what that feels like. If I'm sitting in somebody else in a spirit's rocking chair and they don't like it, I want to know what that feels like. As you just sitting there getting poked in the shoulder. Hey, buddy.
You ever had a ghost slap you in the back of the head?
Right. Now, the next one.
Cut a ghost switch and smack you with a ghost switch.
Ghost switch. Ugh. You ever had to do that? You ever had to go get a switch?
Once.
Yeah, it sucks.
Yeah.
Now, the next one was Horace Potter. Now, Horace Potter was the sheriff in McConnellsville at the turn of the 1900s. On September 7th, 1905, he was ambushed in the alley behind the Twin City Opera House. The local town lunatic shot Sheriff Porter in the back of the head four times with a .32 caliber handgun. This is the one that blew me away. This gun was used once again by prosecutor Frank Parsons on Sunday, October 3rd, 1909, when he took his own life in the Morgan County courthouse. So what, he goes and gets a gun from evidence from a crime in 1905 and shoots himself?
Yeah. That's wild.
So it's caused the investigators to speculate, is there an attachment to this gun? You know, does this gun have something attached to it that's, you know, causes it to be involved in all these tragedies?
Yeah, that's possible.
But the gun itself is now part of a display at the Morgan County Historical Society. So that's pretty interesting. But it says that Sheriff Porter still makes his rounds in the alley behind the Opera House. Mediums have felt and heard the shooting, and a recurrent shadow man is seen in the Opera House is believed to be Horace Potter.
Hmm.
Now, with all of this activity, you know, there is something that you eventually get to, and that's portals.
Oh.
You know, portals are what is causing these hauntings to be so active. And it is believed that the Twin City Opera House has two open portals. One portal is located in the catwalk next to where Robert's Wine is. And the other one is located in the sub-basement coming out of the entrance to the original tunnels, which connected the four corners of the town square and allowed people to pass into the streets. Okay? Now those. Okay.
If there was going to be one, I could see it being at that tunnel.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, we're coming back to these tunnels that, you know, Adam talked about earlier. Now, the portals make the Opera House activity change from day to day. And many investigators and psychics, mediums that have visited, they compare the tunnels to a train station. I said, so, you know, people come to the train station, they hang around for a little while, then they get on another train and they leave. It's the same with the spirits. One day there may be one traveler at the Opera House. Other day that number may change. Some nights there's a light and friendly feel, and on others it seems darker and more foreboding. Investigators say they never know what to expect until they actually set foot in the Opera House.
Hmm. That would be weird. That would kind of throw a wrench in my theory of spirits getting used to you.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't get used to you if they were always coming and going.
Yeah. Now this last one we're going to discuss is really, really, really cool. And Adam, I'll get your take on it after you've heard this story.
Okay.
One of the most common requests made by those who visit the Opera House is to see Charlie. Everybody wants to see Charlie. But who is Charlie? Investigators aren't sure that Charlie was ever alive.
Oh, no.
They aren't sure if Charlie was male or female. Some psychic mediums that have visited the basement say that he is evil. While others say that he was a very bad person in life, therefore, he's a bad spirit in death. It's been said that Charlie is a poltergeist or something from another dimension making his way through the portal in the basement. But regardless of who or what Charlie is, paranormal investigators agree that when he appears, the room gets very heavy. They almost describe it like standing in a sauna. Some visitors have become nauseated, while others have complained of headaches, resulting in having to leave the area. But whenever Charlie arrives, the other spirits inhabiting the Opera House disappear.
Hmm.
So when the United Paranormal Project started investigating the Opera House in the early 2000s, they met up with Charlie. As they investigated more and more, Charlie's presence and energy got more intense. And at one point, Eric Glosser, the investigator, former police officer who I mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
stated he was giving a tour to a team prior to their investigation. While in the sub-basement, he felt himself being laid back and levitated. And then he was dropped from about a foot off the ground. So essentially, somebody walked up to you and that had like the trust fall, you know, they rock him back and then drug him and actually lifted him off the ground and then dropped him. Mm. Now here's the thing. Eric was a 300-pound man. And the team that witnessed this had no reasonable explanation on how he did it, because they immediately thought, oh, this is a trick. This is a gag for our benefit. We're coming in here as guests, and you've got... Nope. You know, Eric swore that he had nothing to do with it, that it was Charlie who had picked him up and dropped him.
That takes some energy to do that, man.
I mean, serious energy.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine, I'd be like, you know, picking, you know, somebody coming up behind me and picking me up. You know, I'm like, it's not going to happen.
And it's crazy that there were that many other witnesses.
Exactly. You know,
it's not just him telling you that it happened. There's at least 3-4 other people that saw it.
Sam Taylor, who is another UPP team member, was quoted as saying, I have personally seen experienced mediums jump up and leave the sub basement when Charlie came out. I was present when one medium said she could see him running towards us from the tunnel area. He was a big ball of black mass, and it looked like he had a big black flowing robe over him. It was flapping in the wind as he approached us.
That's creepy. It's
pretty terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, the UPP has a very interesting theory of what Charlie might be. The team explains that after a particularly bad time in his life, Eric met the new, you know, love of his life, Carla. And his moods and perceptions became more positive. The same was true of the Opera House. As the team investigated, they noticed that Charlie was present less and less, and they also noticed less dark activity in the sub-basement. So the UPP theorizes that Charlie may have been a thought form, like a poltergeist, a negative ball of energy, or something like that. He was accidentally created due to the trauma Eric had from getting injured and no longer being able to work. Now, as his new life with Carla brought joy and happiness back into his world, there was less and less negative energy to feed Charlie. So Charlie weakened and was present less and less. Now, unfortunately, Eric Glosser passed away in the summer of 2021 at age 57. But Charlie has not been seen since.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And,
you know, that is really intriguing, because when we discuss poltergeists in the past, that is one of the things that they always try to tie in, is that there is an energy there that is causing the poltergeist activity. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, the whole idea of teenage girls, you know, going into puberty, all of the changes in their emotions and their bodies and everything just being so hyped up. Hey, guess what? I know that, because I got four daughters, and I got one of them right now that, you pass her in the hallway, she's, you know, just as likely to come up and give you a big hug as to try to knock your head off. Okay. It's hard, man. It's hard. And I feel bad for her, because I watched her sisters go through it too. But you know, it's always made me think, is this door that opens and shuts down here while I'm up here recording, you know, some type of poltergeist activity because I have a teenage girl, a preteen girl going through all this?
Could be.
You know, it's happened tonight. You know, it happened last week. And I'm just kind of like, what the heck is going on? But yeah, I mean, that is an incredibly awesome theory. You know, to believe that, you know, when Eric Glosser was going through a really difficult time in his life, that is when the activity from Charlie really kicked into high gear.
Well, and I had a theory starting out when you started talking about it, but obviously it changed because with Eric passing away and Charlie not being seen anymore. But I mean, it still could, if it was not a thought form or a poltergeist, tulpa, something that he created, what if it was a demonic entity that was attached to him because of his previous life as a police officer? They see a lot of terrible things, and they're in a lot of terrible places with tragedies and stuff. And if he was not in a good mindset, he could have gotten an attachment to him. And the thing I've noticed, and tell me if you, when I mention this, if you go, oh yeah, I've noticed that too. A lot of these demonic or negative energies that we run across, they have names like Charlie, Willie, Jesse, something cutesy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like Buck or
Maximilian. You know, none of that.
My name is Dallas Burnwood. You know, it's nothing like.
That's an awesome name.
Yeah, that's going to be my next dog, Dallas Burnwood. but it's not something like tough sounding or whatever. It's something that
kind of
flies under your radar. Yeah. Right. It flies under your radar and makes you think it's not something intimidating, like Charlie. Well, Charlie doesn't say, I mean, my mom has a Chihuahua named Charlie. Now, he's kind of a demon because he's a Chihuahua, but that's a whole nother story.
You could take him if you had to.
Right, exactly. I can beat up a Chihuahua. I don't think I could beat up this demonic entity, but it kind of feels like, to me, less of a tulpa, less of a thought form that he created, and more of an attachment that he had. And yes, when he was foul from losing his job and all this, it gained energy. Mm-hmm. But then as he got happy, his life was straightening out, then he was feeding this demonic presence less, and it went away. And I don't know. I to me, it feels like more of an attachment than a creation, but it's an interesting thought that they have, that maybe it is they would know better than I would,
right,
of the activity. But from what I hear, it sounds like an oppressive attachment.
Sure. I agree. But whichever kind of theory you subscribe to, that's a really, it's just a fascinating story. And to even theorize that, I think the UPP is on the right track. I think their thinking is correct. That it was something negative, but it did have either, it was created by or drawn to, you know, Eric, when he was having a really hard time in his life. And, you know, I hate when I find out that, you know, I had read all this stuff that he had written. I had read these interviews. And then as I'm digging deeper in the research, I find out that, you know, this guy had passed away because, you know,
I saw an interview with him.
Oh yeah. He was on all kinds of shows. He was in Portals, Portals to Hell. You know, with Jack Osborne, you know, so, I mean, he was very active in the, investigations, you know, right up until the end of his life. So you could tell this was something he was very passionate about. Not having ever known him, it just makes me go, man, you know, with the stuff that you and I are interested in and that we research, it'd be great to have someone like that still around.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
But tell us what you guys think. I mean, we've shared a lot of stories about the Twin Cities Opera House. Is it a place that, you know, our listeners in Ohio and West Virginia and Pennsylvania, even in that area, have you heard stories about it? Have you known people that had visited? Maybe you've seen it. Let us know. And the best place to do that is our Facebook group. Thousands of people sharing personal experiences every day. You know, we've got, you know, jokes and people asking for help with weird things happening in their house. whatever, it doesn't matter. It's a safe place. No one's going to make fun of you. We all just want to hear those incredible stories. That's why we're here. You know, we want to hear those stories. And when you're done there, go and check out our website, which is graveyardpodcast.com. There you can find links to purchase Graveyard Tales merchandise. You can listen to the show and you can become a patron. And don't forget, our $10 patrons have access to our new show. Have we even mentioned the name of our new show on here yet?
I think we did once. Yeah.
Well, our new show is called SideQuest. It is available for our $10 patrons. So, you know, if you've been on the fence, hey, now is the perfect time to go and you get access to Adam and I's new project. You know, I think you're really going to love it, man. I tell you what, this has been one of my favorite episodes that we've done in a while. You know,
The evidence and the stories is just amazing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's fantastic. So until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.